Let me just tell you a little bit about this book for those of you who aren't familiar with it. It's a labor of love for me. This is a theater in a building that I've known since I was, I don't know, 11, 12 years old, maybe younger, and just been obsessed by it. And I'm guessing that most of you in this room have some such building in your lives. And I hope we have a chance to maybe hear about your own building obsessions as the evening wears on. This is the Fulton Theater in my hometown of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. It is one of the oldest, if not the oldest, continuously operating theaters in the United States. It was one of the great roadhouses in the golden age of the American theater in the late 19th century. And many, many important performers played that stage, Buffalo Bill among them, Edwin Booth, Sarah Bernhardt, Mrs. Fisk, W.C. Fields, the list goes on and on, something like 10,000 performances in its history. And during that heyday, that golden age of the American theater, there were 4,000 such theaters in this country. And today, about 300 of them survive, which is sad to me. They're difficult buildings to support, obviously, but tribute to those communities who have kept these theaters alive. And Michigan has its share. We've got Adrian Opera House, Manistee Opera House. We've even got our own vaudeville house down the street. So treasure these buildings. Do what you can to support them. They all have stories like the one that I tried to tell in this book. So to get us started, I want to read just a few paragraphs about my hero in this book, a man named Blasius Yecker, who bought Fulton Hall, which was the town hall in Lancaster, built in 1852. He bought Fulton Hall in 1865, just maybe 6 months after the end of the Civil War. And he decided, for reasons I will never quite understand, that he wanted to turn it into he wanted to be Barnum, and wanted to turn it into a great roadhouse. So let me give you just a few paragraphs from that moment in the book. The chapter is called Mr. Yecker Opens a Theater, 1866. 6 months had passed since the end of the war between the states, and Lancaster was thriving. The funerals of boys too young to die had stopped. The papers no longer published accounts of battles so ghastly they defied belief. Instead of troops, trains carried ordinary men and women back and forth to places like Philadelphia and Baltimore. Ships on the Susquehanna heaved under the weight of new merchandise, plows and threshing machines, carriages, firearms, wagons, umbrellas, cigars, hats, distilled liquors, my favorites. Soon the cotton mills would be back in business and gas lights would flicker in every home in the city. Soon work would begin on a granite monument in the center of town to commemorate those who had given their lives in the terrible fight to preserve the Union. Already, those brave men had begun to lapse into memory, their vibrant selves reduced to quicksilver images inside little cases their mothers and widows kept on the parlor table or carried in their pockets. The circus came to town, and families went in throngs to see the clowns and acrobats. From time to time, someone lit a gas valve under a giant balloon and rose from downtown into the blue sky over south central Pennsylvania, while hundreds below watched in wonder. People craved amusement. They wanted to laugh at minstrel shows and see cowboys shoot Indians and hear famous actors declaim Shakespeare. Blasius Yecker thought it might be a good time to open a theater. A small man with a round face and dark hair who spoke English with a German accent. He said little publicly about why he wanted to go into show business. He was in his early 30s. He'd come to America from Europe at 13, leaving his widowed mother and traveling by diligence to Paris from his Alsatian birthplace, and then by train to Le Havre, then by boat across the Atlantic in the dead of winter to New York, and finally to Lancaster, where he had worked first as a farmer and a miller, and then apprenticed as a saddler and opened a harness shop. Now he wanted to be Barnum. He had a petite German-born wife and 4 children, soon to be 7, and they belonged to a large German community whose members attended German language churches and sang in German choirs and drank lager at picnics in the woods on the edge of town. I've wondered sometimes how similar that life is to what must have gone on here in Ann Arbor in the 19th century. Yecker had fled hunger and revolution in Europe and survived a war in his adopted land, and he was an optimist. The saddlery business had prospered during the war, the demand for trunks and bridles and knapsacks ever mounting, and he now had the means to buy property. Accordingly, on November 23, 1865, he and a business partner, Hilaire Zepfel, a former saddler turned hotel keeper, paid $16,200 for a three-story brick tenement with a creamy white facade near the corner of Prince and King Streets in downtown Lancaster. The building, Fulton Hall, was 13 years old, although its stone foundations went back more than a century. Behind its pale veneer, Fulton Hall was little more than an assortment of meeting rooms and a large auditorium with rows of wooden benches and a small platform at one end. Since 1852, this building had served the citizens of Lancaster as a courthouse, stage, chapel, armory, auditorium, boot camp, warehouse, meeting place, concert hall, lecture room, exhibition space, ballroom, campaign rally ground, and occasional funeral parlor. Yecker wanted to turn it into a theater, a place to see and be seen. He envisioned a wide stage and a drop curtain with scenes of Europe, tiered seats, a domed ceiling, low footlights. It's doubtful he knew anything about Thespis, or the Teatro Olimpico, or London's Globe, about the myriad ways theater had entered people's imaginations through history and shaped civilizations and occasionally threatened governments. He simply saw a chance to make money and perhaps his mark. I want to read one other relatively small section to you, and that's about the reaction to theater after Lincoln's assassination. One of the very first shows that Yecker put on in the theater in 1866, after he took over, was Our American Cousin, which was the play that Lincoln, was comedy, pretty dreadful one, that Lincoln was watching at Ford's Theater in April 1865 when John Wilkes Booth stole into his the flag-draped box and shot him below his ear. And so this is just a little bit about, and the people of Lancaster, by the way, Lincoln had come through Lancaster, given a speech on his way to his inauguration, and then 4 years later, his funeral train came through the same railroad depot, and people lined up by the hundreds to look at that. So Lancaster had a kind of direct connection with Lincoln. So backtracking to the assassination, in the aftermath of Lincoln's assassination, people across America had lashed out against the theater, against actors in particular, reviving prejudices that went back to Plato, who believed that mimesis provoked foul thoughts and dreams. Within minutes of Booth's lurid plunge to the stage and Shakespearean cry, "Sic semper tyrannis," audience members in Ford's theater were calling for the building to be burnt and its actors killed. A Washington shopkeeper who dared to suggest that the cast of Our American Cousin was not responsible for the president's death had his neck put in a noose. In Detroit, a minister barked, "Would that Mr. Lincoln had fallen elsewhere than at the very gates of hell, in the theater." An Illinois clergyman announced that by going to see a play, Lincoln had forfeited God's divine protection. Actors everywhere were suspect. Booth's brother Edwin, one of the most celebrated of American players, declared his career ended. Papers in Lancaster carried this statement: "While mourning in common with all other loyal hearts the death of the president, I am oppressed by a private woe not to be expressed in words. But whatever calamity may befall me or mine, my country, one and indivisible, has been my warmest devotion. Edwin Booth." His assurances fell on mostly deaf ears. In the next weeks, death threats were poured into Booth's New York apartment, where he remained under house arrest. Fulton Hall stayed open after Lincoln's assassination, even as local businesses hung black bunting from their windows, and rumors circulated that John Wilkes Booth was on the run in Pennsylvania, not far from Lancaster. Within 24 hours of the president's death, the Fulton presented an evening of comedy and burlesque that included both a laughable farce and a panorama of the recent war. Wittingly or not, those who attended the show were rendering homage to Lincoln, who had loved the theater. Even in the bleakest months of his presidency, as the numbers of Union dead and wounded climbed, Lincoln found time to go to plays, farces, melodramas, Irish comedies, Shakespeare. He had seen John Wilkes Booth and Richard III and other works, and he had liked the actor. Whitman, Walt Whitman, marveled that so powerful a leader drew such pleasure from, quote, those human jackstraws moving about with their silly little gestures, foreign spirit, and flatulent text. But Whitman, too, loved playgoing. He admired especially John Wilkes Booth's father, Junius Brutus Booth, an alcoholic rogue who had thrilled American audiences in the first half of the 19th century with his volcanic performances. In a sense, Lincoln's murder both cursed and sanctified the American theater. All faiths establish holy sites in places where significant events occurred or are presumed to have occurred, in places haunted by memory. And the secular faith of the American stage in 1865 was no different. Walk into a theater after April 14th of that year, and you beheld the setting for a crime. Here were the audience, the actors, the melodrama. On the night of the actual assassination, this is incredible, some in the crowd thought Booth's histrionics were part of the play. Down in front, people shouted when others stood to see what was happening. Sit down. Who was real that evening? Certainly not the actress Laura Keene, who emerged from Ford's theater in a yellow costume spattered with blood. Witnesses gasped. She looked like a ghost. Harrison, a man named Harrison who came to Lancaster in 1866 to reenact Our American Cousin, Harrison's reenactment of the play that killed Lincoln drew a large crowd to Fulton Hall on February 26, 1866. Yecker must have been pleased. Soon he would start filling a book with records of Fulton engagements. That same month, in New York City, Edwin Booth returned to the stage in his signature role, Hamlet, a part he would later reprise at the Fulton. Passions had cooled since his brother's capture and death the previous spring, and Edwin needed money. Despite threats from the public and attacks by the press, his return was a triumph, and the audience that evening showered Booth with flowers and applause. Likewise, at the Fulton, patrons of Our American Cousin must have felt a frisson when George W. Harrison, as Asa Trenchard, the play's hapless Yankee hero, spoke the very words actor Henry Hawk had uttered at Ford's just before Lincoln was shot. Well, I guess I know enough to turn you inside out, you sockdologizing old man-trap. Lest Lancastrians forget the horror of that moment, the Evening Express had published an account of it the day before the performance, noting how Hawks's hilarious delivery had given way to the crack of a pistol and then chaos. Now they were reliving the incident here in Lancaster, imagining the president in his box, the audience shouting, "Who was he?" And hang him, as the villain Booth, clad in black, leapt to the stage and Hawk fled, afraid Booth would stab him. Later that February evening, as they made their way home along Lancaster's gaslit streets or stopped for a glass of beer at Henry Struble's Fulton Hall restaurant, members of the Fulton crowd may have pondered the irony that it was an actor of all people who had conjured the shocking finale to the long war. As Thaddeus Stevens, who was the representative from Lancaster, would observe, in the midst of the most exquisite enjoyment of his favorite relaxation, Lincoln was instantaneously taken away, end quote. That, too, was part of the theater's spell. So I'll turn it over to you. And hope we can talk about some of these issues.
Thanks, Leslie. That's terrific. Well, we thought tonight we'd sort of use Leslie's book as a sort of jumping off place to maybe have a more freewheeling conversation about theater and the role of theater in our culture now and then. And what we're and even in the context of our own community here in Ann Arbor. But before we kind of move on to the conversation, I thought I would turn it over to Lee and Martin with just some opening remarks or reactions to Leslie's book and thoughts that you kind of walked away with.
Yeah. If you love the theater, read this book. It's really, really good. It's a micro-history in the sense that it's about the Fulton Theater and about Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where Leslie was born and grew up. It's also a history of the United States in ways that you will have gathered from what Leslie just read, and it's a history of herself. And I can tell you that it's very hard as an historian to write about yourself in a way that's modest and charming, and you do.
My local paper didn't, in Lancaster, the hometown paper, thought I had done a little bit of too much information.
But, oh, yeah.
But that's Lancaster. Ann Arbor's a little bit more open.
Which I said yesterday when we were talking.
Not enough.
If you ever want to write a memoir, please do. I will read the whole thing. It would be fabulous.
I'll let you know.
Because I'm a theater historian, I just want to gloss Booth a little bit. The way he made his way to the box was because he knew the backstage. Hmm. And the day before, he drilled a hole in the door so he could see...
John Wilkes Booth.
Not Edwin. And he knew where the laughs were, so he used the laughs to enter Lincoln's box.
Yeah, that makes sense, of course.
Chilling, isn't it? What I did was I cruised the index. Some of the names Leslie's already mentioned, but I wanted to give you an idea of the scope of this book. So I'll just mention some names. You'll know some of them, at least maybe most of them, who figure in this book. Luther Adler played Fiddler on the Roof on Broadway. I think he was Zero Mostel's first replacement, and the Adlers were an important family in the Yiddish theater in New York. George Aiken was the first person to dramatize Uncle Tom's Cabin. So when you read Uncle Tom's Cabin in an anthology these days, it's usually Aiken's adaptation that you're reading. And he also toured in Troops and played the role of George, the sort of whitish slave. Bert Williams was a person of color. He was born in the Caribbean. His fame was with Williams and Walker. They were the first black people to perform as leading roles on Broadway. W.C. Fields said of him once, he was the funniest man I ever saw and the saddest man I ever knew. Thaddeus Stevens, whom you mentioned, it's Tommy Lee Jones in the movie Lincoln. He was a fire-eating abolitionist, and he wore the most terrible wigs you've ever seen. It's hard to imagine, really. Buffalo Bill, you know who he was. He had a long and lucrative career, not just in this country, but he toured in Europe as well. Ethel Barrymore, from a famous theatrical family. George M. Cohan, the Yankee Doodle Dandy. Douglas Fairbanks, who was a stage actor before he became a film actor and a star. Helen Hayes, the grand dame of American theater in the early half of the 20th century. Theda Bara, whose name was an anagram. I think it's Black Death or something like that. She was Theodosia something, and she was from Cincinnati. I think she donned a bogus Slavic identity. W.C. Fields, he was famous as a juggler in vaudeville before he ever sort of found comedy. And people who saw him said he was the best juggler they ever saw. James Buchanan was president of the United States and was from nearby Lancaster, right?
He's from, born elsewhere, but lived in Lancaster, and his house is not far from the Fulton. And he actually never, so far as I can tell, performed on the Fulton stage, but he sat there multiple times. He was on the board of my alma mater, Franklin and Marshall College, and they held commencement services there. And so he definitely was in that theater.
Lincoln succeeded Buchanan as president. And
did a slightly better job.
I mean, yeah, really. Really. Being a president then was going to be a mess in any case. Buchanan didn't help. Edwin Booth, Leslie's already talked about it at length. Mrs. Patrick Campbell, her famous role was the second Mrs. Tanqueray. Yeah. She played Scarlet Women, and was as she got older, she got crazier. Chang and Eng were the original Siamese twins. They were joined, I think, at the shoulder, at the chest. And they were sideshow attractions and vaudeville attractions for many years. Patti LuPone, some of us will remember, because she was the first American Evita on stage, and that's one of the most incandescent performances I've ever seen. And James O'Neill was the father of Eugene O'Neill. His famous role was as the Count of Monte Cristo, and he felt like he'd sold out to the role. It certainly made him a lot of money. So he had nothing to complain about that way. So
see Long Day's Journey into Night.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where there's talk of selling out. So I just wanted to give you sort of a thumbnail sketch. There are other people in the book, including, and not least, Leslie herself, mm-hmm. who grew up in the theater and who had important life events happen there. So.
Well, ditto. It's a very wonderful book, and I highly recommend it. Everything that Lee said about it is true. It's very rich in theater history, American history in general. And personally, I was getting all kinds of wonderful vibes from it, because it's not just a memoir and a history of a particular building, but Leslie gets into some fairly deep meditations on time and memory and place. There's all kinds of, I think, Ortega y Gasset and several other philosophers are mentioned in passing, you know, quite easily insinuated into the historical narrative. And what impressed me the most about it as a complete study is the way the theater was this place in American life in the 19th century, particularly where America was fashioning its own image and doing it, well, making the thing that we would now call American exceptionalism at the expense of the black population, right, of the native population. That's constantly going on in all kinds of theatrical forms, not just plays, but tableaus, living tableaus, and all kinds of exhibitions. So it started ringing all kinds of bells for me of weird things that happened in American historical life. You don't mention it, but there is a bizarre theatrical Native American incident in the early 19th century, about 1805 or so. A man named John Jewett was captured. He was a whaler, New England whaler, captured by the Nootka in the northwest coast, and he came back after several years as a slave of the chief, but having some status, and managed to bring a lot of paraphernalia back with him after his captivity. And he began to do stage shows and the dances and rituals that he had learned, right, as a member of this Native American community for entertainment, to raise money to stay alive. And this sort of thing is happening all the way through the 19th century, and I think Leslie captures that very well in the book. Buffalo Bill restaging the American frontier for us, right? And eventually actually using real Native Americans, including Sitting Bull himself. And then that gets theatricalized further with Annie, Get Your Gun, and all of that is tumbling around in this this wonderful narrative.
If I can just one thing,
you can do whatever you want. Well, you wrote the book.
No, I know, but I've already, I'm bore you to tears. But the other thing that makes this theater absolutely unique among American theaters, and why I so wanted to write this book, is part that I just forgot to say in my introduction. The foundations of the theater are the stone walls of the colonial jail in Lancaster, which was built roughly 1730. And in 1763, it's a complicated story, and but the last surviving members of the Conestoga Indians were brought into that jail for their own safekeeping. It was kind of during Pontiac's Rebellion. There were lots of attacks by vigilantes. And on December 27, 1763, a gang from the town of Paxton, which was outside of Harrisburg, which, if you can imagine, was then the American frontier, came into Lancaster, broke into the jail, and massacred the last of 14 members of the Conestoga Indians, men, women, children. It was a brutal massacre. It was one of the early, early episodes in the genocide of the American Indian. And they then went on to Philadelphia, where they were going to kill more Indians. And actually, a group of Philadelphia officials, mostly Quakers, came out and stopped them. One of them was Ben Franklin. And then this huge, so then they... the vigilantes backed off, but this pamphlet war erupted. 60 or 70 pamphlets were published with people pro and con what had happened in Lancaster. And Franklin himself wrote a very important piece about the late massacre of the Conestogas in Lancaster. He was absolutely appalled by the savagery of what had happened. So that happened inside the walls of what later became this theater. And, you know, so 90 years later, when Buffalo Bill comes in and performs on the stage, he's absolutely reenacting the genocide with bands of genuine Indians above ground where the genocide took place. The other thing I discovered while writing this book was that that jail continued to function as a jail for the better part of a century after the Indians were, after the Conestogas were killed, and before Fulton Hall was built. And during that time, among the many people that were incarcerated were countless numbers of African Americans fleeing slavery in the South. They would cross the Susquehanna River, come into Columbia, and in many cases they were held in the jail while abolitionists worked to free them, and in some cases they succeeded. In other cases, these African Americans were sent back into slavery. So this theater is implicated in the two great crimes on which this democratic country is founded, and that was something I just couldn't let go of. And the, you know, the incredible metaphorical, whatever, paradox that a theater where the first show to play Fulton Hall when it opened in 1852 was a minstrel show where you're mocking plantation slavery. I mean, it just, the, you know, the strangenesses pile up.
I wonder, the book is an incredible, I read the book and I left the impression thinking, I can't believe how much American history can be contained and sort of communicated through a single building, right? And I think that's really kind of the central thesis of the book. And I started to wonder also about your process of actually researching the book and kind of what went into, where did you start?
I asked Martin Walsh, who is the most amazing Renaissance man, and some, I don't know, we had a conversation, it's like 13, 14 years ago, and I said I was working on this, and you knew all about the Paxton Massacre.
Yeah, only about the Paxton boys.
And he hands me a bibliography. I couldn't believe it. I don't know. You know, any of these, when you guys, you know, research, it's you follow a thread, you follow a thread, you come up, it's a labyrinth, you come up against a dead end and all that. But I did, one of the really pleasurable things, I mean, one really pleasurable thing was going back to my hometown where I haven't lived in over 30 years, and getting to know it from that perspective. So I totally recommend that to anybody who has that idea in their minds. It's a wonderful way of sort of getting to know where you came from.
Well, I think a lot of us will be a little bit jealous that we don't have a building quite like that. It's been that part of our lives.
Yeah. So. Did you always know it would be a history of the theater? Is that where the, was that the genesis of the idea?
Well, I always thought, you know, it's, I don't know, you know how it is when you write a book. Something just grabs hold of you and you can't let go. You have an obsession. So, yeah, I really did wrestle with how to tell it. And I kind of reluctantly, I call it a reluctant memoir. I mean, I put myself in there finally because otherwise, it was, you know, how do you tell the story of a building that has had 10,000 performances, that's been around for over 200 years, and, I mean, without just having it turn into and then and then and then. So I felt that if I could sort of filter it through my life. Also, I truly don't find the late 20th century history of the building that interesting, although some people, historic preservationists, would. And there was an interesting fight. They were going to tear it down in the 60s, 1960s, and turn it into a parking garage, as was true of so many buildings in this country. But I thought if I could sort of fast forward and tell my story in the late 20th, early 21st century, that would sort of take care of that part of it. You would know that it's still a living theater without my having to sort of unspool that whole part of the story. So I probably didn't answer your question, but
no, that's yes, you did. The other, I guess, the other bit of that too would be, what do you think? You know, beyond kind of a thread, you know, or a way of kind of telling that 20th century, late 20th century history through your memoir, what did sort of writing as a memoir unlock for you?
Well, I tried to be pretty selective about the memoir part and make sure that it really was germane to the larger story of the theater. I guess more than anything, it allowed me to explore the really interesting ways that I think life and acting blend into one another. I mean, we're all acting all the time, right? We imagine, these are things I want to hear your thoughts on this, because you guys do a whole lot more of it than I do anymore. But you think about how we imagine our lives in scenes, how we remember our lives in scenes and dialogue. And I just think it's such an incredibly rich exploration. You know, why, as questions I want to know from all of you, why do we need theater? Why do we still go to live plays? What happens in the exchange when you're in an audience at the Power Center watching something unfold in front of you with live actors? What happens in that interchange, that moment, that doesn't happen necessarily when you go to a movie? It's not to say movies don't, I mean, movies are an incredible way that we work out our American identity. Look at Selma, for instance. But
American Sniper as well.
Yeah.
See them back to back.
So I'm interested in, I mean, you're an actor. You know, what your thoughts on that phenomenon?
Well, it's, I've always appreciated it as a way to understand myself better. And what I say to students is that it's another way of studying psychology. It's a way of thinking about why people do what they do. And it's a way of thinking about the difference between what people say and what they do. Mm-hmm. So that's what's grabbed me.
Yeah.
For me, I guess it's kind of being elsewhere. Not just another character, but another time and place, and sort of in suspension. I'm dead for that bit while I'm being this character, and then I can resume. So it's a weird Dionysiac resurrection kind of thing, I think, is going on.
And the writing process is very much like that. I mean, certainly when you're writing about history, trying to imagine yourself back to what I actually went. You know, one of the things I did, I studied costume design years ago. I used to work in costume shops, and I had these wonderful costume books that I hauled out while I was working. You know, go through like, what were they wearing back then? Okay, can I have him wearing breeches or what? You know, but it was really fun to try to put all that together, and then you're sort of recreating a history, or re-envisioning it or envisioning it for the first time in ways that you just didn't quite know. So that idea of putting yourself in another space. Mm.
To act in an old play, I think you have to imagine yourself in olden times. And as an historian, I've always really liked doing that. I grew up around great-great-grandparents, so history was alive for me in a way. The theater does the same thing.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, for my vantage point, doing what I do at UMS, I think a lot about why audiences would want to go to that experience of live theater or live music. I mean, I certainly hope they want to, because I really believe in it in a personal way, but it was interesting as we were preparing for tonight and trying to think about, you know, what are the forces sort of in the world right now that are really competing with that live experience. And of course, everyone's really pointing towards, you know, every experience we have being mediated by some kind of screen or technology. And maybe there's this opportunity suddenly again with live performance to really sort of heighten the specialness of the idea that you have to be in space for it to happen at a certain time with other people who breathe and make noise and smell and, you know, push on you. And then, of course, you hear of many performers talk about the sort of energetic exchange that happens between the people that are, you know, quote unquote, the performers and then the spectators. It's something, and this book actually made me think quite a lot about Hill Auditorium and the kind of function that Hill as a kind of concert venue and lecture hall has sort of held in our community in Ann Arbor, and probably maybe one of the longest lasting sort of extant spaces for performance, at least, if not theater. But one of the things that performers often talk about when they talk about Hill is, even though it's now, you know, it's now a 3,500 seat hall, it used to be a 4,200 seat hall, that it feels as if it's a 100-seat hall, and that they can feel actually the audience around them. They can hear the audience around them. That has something to do with the acoustic design. But there's something to be really, there's something to be said for that.
And how performers feed on that, yeah. Right?
I mean, was the Fulton for a time in the 20th century just showing films?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think of that every time I go into the Michigan Theater or the State Theater or Grotzi's. There are the ghosts of
the ghosts of
those
buildings
in those buildings. The Michigan Theater was built, as you may know, as a vaudeville house. And I think the State may have been too. The Grotzi's, whatever it was called, was most definitely a vaudeville house.
The Orpheum, I think.
I'd forgotten.
Was it an Orpheum?
Yeah, I think they have some sort of picture sign up in there.
Several years ago, the Michigan Theater did a full show of Charlie Chaplin's The Circus with a live vaudeville act, and they had a sort of stage, prop, sort of circus props on the stage itself, right? And then there was this vaudeville show live. I think they sang the Ypsilanti song, whatever that is. and then they showed the film, so this, this interpenetration of the film media and but still the old live performance, right? And it's sort of spilling out into the audience with real circus props.
Fabulous.
What's quite intriguing, but I don't think they ever did it again. Or
interesting.
They discontinued that sort of thing.
It was an anniversary.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Of the Michigan Theater. Yeah.
I think one of the other things, too, that really struck me, certainly there are big questions about race and identity that are embedded in your book and in the history that you're recounting. And I guess one of the things that I found really fascinating, and you sort of make a case about it for three different identity groups, is the ways in which women, Native Americans, African American performers were able to take on these roles, which were actually just incredibly sort of detrimental and awful in terms of how their identities were portrayed in sort of the public imagination. But it allowed those individuals a certain kind of freedom. Women who played these, scarlet women roles were then allowed to sort of travel freely without a chaperone, and the expectation for, marriage or children went away. And so that was actually an advantage. The same thing for these Native American performers who traveled with Bill Cody.
Yeah, they got off the reservation.
They got off the reservation. They were able to travel relatively freely. It's such an irony.
I have to tell one little story. It was one of my favorite stories from this, and it was just, I used to spend a lot of time trawling through newspapers, and I came across this one. I just loved this anecdote. There was a woman named Mae Fisk, who and her troupe of naughty blondes came through. And one of the interesting things about Yecker, my hero manager, theater manager, was he struggled throughout roughly 40 years that he was running this theater, to strike this balance between salacious entertainment, the stuff that's going to fill the seats, and, there weren't really censor authorities, but, the naysayers who would want to shut down the theater or just stay away and get other people to stay away. So he would bring high and low, but he was very good at doing this balance because the local people trusted him. But anyhow, he brought in Mae Fisk and her naughty blondes, and at some point while she was performing, the lights went out, a fire alarm went off. I think that's right, something like that. And so they shouted, and one of her naughty blondes got up on the stage and said, "Don't worry, everybody, just stay in your seats. The drinks will be brought in." You can imagine how that went over. This is like the height of temperance and all this kind of
that's
stuff.
Great.
In Lancaster. Too much information. They never got invited back to the theater. But I love that. I just love that story. But yeah, it's incredible when you think of these, I looked at the pictures of Yecker's daughters at the turn of the century. Mm-hmm. And they are, corseted up like trussed like chickens in their, beautiful, it's A-line skirt and a little wasp waist and, you know, stuff up to their necks. And here's their father bringing in leg shows. And the leg shows were incredibly popular. There was, what was it, Mazeppa, the one where flew around on a horse or something like that, you know, with almost nothing on?
Riding bareback.
Yeah. You know, and this is late 19th century America, and it's happening on the stage. But one of the books that I rely on so much, and it's maybe a little dated now, but Michael Goldman's The Actor's Freedom, and he talks about the terrible, terrifying, extraordinary freedom that actors have, and that to me is, and the energy that they have, and it's still true. I mean, you know, you go to the theater and you watch Othello murder his wife, and that's all fine, and then you applaud when it's over. Now, if you think about that, you know, in real life, we would not be applauding, and it's amazing the kind of freedom that theater gives you to go and enjoy stuff that otherwise is completely taboo. And I just think that's a, I don't know, you guys want to riff on that, but that to me is just so fascinating, the freedom of the stage.
Well, Shakespeare knew that too. Sex and violence, it's
sells.
Thrilling.
Yeah.
I want to circle back around to this question of sort of race and identity, and it also made me think towards I wonder how, you know, theater department productions, Martin, that you're working on with students as well, how you're sort of grappling with questions around race and identity with students in those work. And certainly there are all kinds of, you know, productions, Shakespearean, Othello, Merchant of Venice, things like Porgy and Bess, West Side Story, where we start to get into really kind of complicated ways of having to portray race on stage. And I wonder how you're grappling with that.
I'll call on a recent example. Some of you may have seen it. The first show in the Arthur Miller Theater in the fall was Good Kids, a new play by Naomi Izuka, based on the Steubenville sexual assault where the football team had their way with a young woman. What was interesting about it, though, was that this play was being rewritten while the students were working on it, and that's a rare experience for them. But the other interesting thing was that it was about sexual assault, and there was a lot of sort of outreach and workshops and this and this and that. Some people who came to see the play were upset enough by what they saw happen that they said there should have been spoiler alerts. There should have been warnings on the lobby.
Wow.
I later learned that the cast and the director had discussed this, and they decided not to, and I don't know what the rationale was, neither do I think that necessarily they should have anticipated or done that. Mm-hmm. But it's a volatile issue, and not everybody is going to agree, and sort of my mantra in theater history class is to say we don't have to agree about what this play means. We don't have to agree about who this character is. And we don't.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you actually brought that up. I think that's also, that play is part of a really interesting initiative amongst the Big Ten theater departments to commission new works for students to work on.
And all of the Big Ten schools are doing this play. Some as stage reading, some as full-scale production. So they understand this as a problem in the academy. Sorry.
Yeah, no, and I thought that production was remarkable in a number of ways. Particularly for giving students a chance to work on material that's very contemporary and potentially controversial and really provocative. Also giving students a chance to play roles that are very close to their own age, which can be unusual in college theater departments. And also just sort of the nature of the work really putting a lot of different, or creating a lot of different roles for women, for young women, and of really different kinds of perspectives in that show. Sort of interesting. If you get a chance to see it somewhere else, or I know they're sort of, this play lives beyond its production in September in a lot of different ways, so you should check it out, look it up. It was called Good Kids.
And what people liked most about the play was also what others liked least, and that is that the playwright she really avoids saying what happened because we can't know. Mm. Or that's the view that she takes, at any rate.
It's definitely an example of, you know, how you use theater, and again, it's that freedom or that it has to explore something that is quite volatile in real life. I mean, this is a completely contemporary front burner issue, and here we are using the stage. You know, it's not an op-ed piece. It's not a newspaper article or whatever, an internet blog or whatever you want to call it. You're using the theater to explore this. And I'm wondering, there's something three-dimensional about the theater because you get all these different voices, right? You get to sort of see and hear from different points of view rather than just having one voice come at you and say, this is how you need to think about this. Is that been your experience when you put touchy material on stage, that it's somehow, I don't know what, theater allows you to explore it from different angles, right? More so than...
Oh, yeah, it's multivalent. There's layers to it, and lots of discussion will go on around a performance. In the classroom... Mm-hmm. We have usually an imbalance, you know, far more women than men, mm-hmm. right? And when you're dealing with classical material, what do you do? Well, women tend to really respond to, you know, jumping into male roles, and that becomes in itself an exploration, right? Shakespeare and so on. So I've had female Falstaffs and female Sir Toby Belches. Transgender person who's playing Viola, who's mm-hmm. a woman pretending to be
great.
A male, and it gets very, very confusing for me, the instructor. But it doesn't seem to be a problem, right? Mm-hmm. But they also want contemporary material. The women want mm-hmm. contemporary material that they can get their hands on and mm-hmm. be some, you know, age specific, gender specific. For a change, because what we tend to be doing. Well, we're doing Lysistrata in Ellen McLaughlin's adaptation currently in one class, and they're just, you know, exploding with joy.
I was going to say, that's got to be a great pleasure to do. Yeah.
And then I, as a theater historian, I say, well, you know, Aristophanes was really saying, here's a preposterous comic premise. Women can organize. And, you know, don't give him credit for it, right? We're appropriating this, right, to our times. So, there's, you know, there's a lot of interesting teaching that can go on. But that balance has to be redressed, right? We need, it's only a couple of Carol Churchills, and we have a couple of good American playwrights, women playwrights. But still, even with a lot of women playwrights, she's still only 50-50, right? We don't have the all-girl plays very much.
I wonder, too, for those of us that really love the theater, which I think all of us do, we, of course, we continue to sort of witness the theater kind of moving further and further to the periphery in a certain way, and... There are certain kinds of theater that are very commercial, like Broadway, for example, that still seem to kind of float around in very much the commercial kind of zeitgeist. And of course, it makes me wonder why anybody would want to go into the theater, except for the love of it, I suppose. But I wonder what these guys are hearing from students. Like, why are students going into the theater?
Do they
all want to be in movies or what?
Yes. They can't help themselves.
Oh, that's a great answer.
No, I think you have to really need to do it. It has to be a drive. Mm-hmm. And a surprising number of people that we see, lucky it is, have this drive. They need to do it. They find it deeply fulfilling. And you talk about that in the book in mm-hmm. interesting ways when you were acting and when you were doing other things. It was a labor of love.
Oh yeah. And I'm kind of glad I mean my joke is I stopped wanting to be an actress because I like having dinner at night. But you know, it's for any parent who's freaked out about their kid going into theater, I mean, it is an incredibly, the skills that you learn by doing theater are not going to be wasted on other careers. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm all for people going into the theater, and if it works, it works, and that's wonderful. But it also teaches you extraordinary flexibility, improvisational skills, public speaking,
collaboration.
I mean, it's amazing the utility and the way it can spread into other areas. So,
I wanted to ask you, Leslie, about what does the Fulton offer in the way of theatrical fare?
Well, they do. You know, it's not my favorite stuff, but they're keeping it afloat. They have, they do a full season, six or seven shows a year. Last summer's big blockbuster was Les Mis, not my favorite item, but you know, it filled the house. What's amazing is I just learned this when I was back there in October. So they've expanded over the years. You know, they've renovated the theater. It's beautiful. If you're ever in Lancaster, go, I know some of you. They've expanded into the building next door and built a black stage or a black box theater on the top of that. And I just found out they are buying up the entire city block.
Wow.
And what they want, this is just unheard of to me.
Yeah.
And it's also a kind of a vision that I didn't think they quite had, to be honest, the current administration, which has done a great job of running it and keeping it in the black. But I didn't think they quite had this vision. But they want, by expanding into these other buildings and cutting into them, they want to actually create, I guess it would be something a little bit like the Metropolitan Opera House, where they can actually do repertory, and they can so shove they can get Les Mis out of the way for one or two nights and bring in a straight play or more difficult play that's going to get smaller audiences, run that for a couple, and then pull it out and do this rep thing. So I think that's an amazing.
Is the block they're buying decrepit and depressed? Is that what makes it affordable?
Well, it's not brilliant, but Lancaster's a funny city. It's this beautiful old colonial city that has really struggled, as so many cities have. There are blocks that are just really funky and thriving with galleries and all that. But like right across from the Fulton, there's kind of a pawn shop, and there's a dollar store, and there's a little nail salon. But then there's kind of a cafe. It's kind of a mishmash. So it's not completely decrepit, but it's probably, Lancaster's cheaper than Ann Arbor so just to give you a sense of real estate. So, but I can't imagine it's completely cheap to be doing what they're doing either. Mm-hmm. But
Where are they getting the money?
I'm not sure. They've actually just asked me to write a letter on their behalf, which is interesting, about the historical value. Suddenly they seem to care about the history of the place more than they used to. So that's all, that's good.
But, did you have anything to do with that?
I feel like I might have a little bit. I mean, it's such a great story. But
does the theater develop local talent? That was one of the things that struck me in the book.
They bring in now, I think they've got some local stringers. I'm not quite sure of the whole equity structure, but they cast in New York. They bring in people, we've actually, some Michigan grads have performed there. But I think there is some local, and they do, there's some educational programming, and that seems to be in flux right now. But
they don't aim at local playwrights or?
They did. I went a couple years ago. They brought in, I don't think he was local, but they tried a sort of new play development thing, and I went to the opening night of one of these plays. It was not a great play. And I don't know if that just sort of fizzled or what, but no, there's not much. And Lancaster's sort of a funny town. It's not, Franklin and Marshall College is there, but it's tiny. Millersville University is there, and it's a state university. But, there's not like the sort of intellectual trappings that Ann Arbor has that we take for granted here. So for instance, I was asking them once about a high-tech corridor. Could they do that in Lancaster as a way of, for local economy? And they said a couple of high-tech companies tried it, and there wasn't the talent that they needed wasn't there. So it's kind of an interesting city.
I wanted to ask you about John Updike. He wrote one play. Mm-hmm. Called Buchanan Dying.
I had a leading role. I did. It's a dreadful play.
What made it a dreadful play?
Well, he wrote it as a play to be read, and so it's very long. And I reread it when I was working on this book, and even then, it was really it's very dense, and it's beyond me, his comprehension of Buchanan. For my money, there aren't enough women in the play either, but that's okay. But really, if you want to read Updike on Buchanan, read Memories of the Ford Administration. It's a fantastic book. We premiered it.
There's a photograph of him in the book.
Yeah. And he was actually lovely and self-effacing. He came to a rehearsal, and the actor who was playing Buchanan, who had this really tough role, and the other problem is it's about a man, Buchanan, who cannot act. Who simply cannot make up his mind to act. I don't mean theatrically acting, but like act as president to fix this problem. He's paralyzed, kind of. And so that is dramatically challenging, right? And he seems bad most of the time remembering, and it's weird. But Updike came, and I remember the actor was struggling with one particular speech, and Updike said, well, just change the line. And he said, really, Mr. Updike? And he said, oh, yeah, just change it. But he was very self-effacing. And
who did you play?
Harriet Lane, Buchanan's niece. So it was the lead female role. The female roles weren't great. The great female role was Ann Coleman, who was the woman who was engaged to Buchanan and then died mysteriously of pneumonia in Philadelphia one night. It's a dramatic story. But there was a scene that Updike wrote where she bares her breast bares her breast to Buchanan as a way of trying to get a rise out of him, a metaphorical rise. And I thought to myself, I wanted that role, but I thought, no way could I do that. And then it turns out the actress who got the role, she couldn't do it either. Yeah. So they did this, I really felt for the actor. They did it with her back to she was facing upstage, and they had some like little piece of fabric in her corset, and she ripped that. So all you saw was the gesture from behind of her ripping it. And the poor actor who's, playing Buchanan has to watch her fumble with this thing and rip this piece of muslin and to make the sound. So I don't know. I'm rattling on here.
This is a digression too, but the first book on directing I ever read, there was a part about stage kissing, and the whole thing was staging it so you don't actually have to kiss.
Just God forbid.
So it was all about sort of masking
right,
and blocking,
right, right, right. Well, and speaking of women playwrights, this wonderful Sarah Rule, who's one of her plays is Stage Kiss, which is really, really good. I did see a hand earlier, and I don't know if it's time
If you want to do questions, we have a microphone that will circulate around. Please wait for the microphone to come to you.
Do you still have a question? Or not?
This is an age test, do you remember?
We've moved on.
Okay.
If it comes back, I can remember what it
please.
Was.
So if you have a question, pop a hand.
Did Updike live nearby? Is that
he grew up in Reading.
How far away is that?
30, 40 minutes. Uh-huh. Yeah, Shillington. Yeah.
What do you think we'd learn by looking at the season? Let me rephrase that. You look at the seasons of the Fulton Theater over 100 years, and you're able to sort of tell the history of the United States. What would we learn from the seasons?
Well, it's
now?
Our television. What they were doing on that stage was what we have on television. There's a lot of junk. There was reality stuff. There were the minstrel shows. I don't know what the comparable thing would be now, but sitcoms. Just some of it, just utter nonsense and dreck.
You'd have your suffragette
the
speakers.
Yeah.
Like your PBS, maybe.
Yeah.
And the pamphlets are your sort of social media.
Probably, yeah. Carrie Nation came through and did her thing on temperance and then went out to a bar and they got into a brawl about that.
Got Sarah Palin on YouTube.
Right, there you go. Favorite moments from this was, again, when I discovered this and stumbled on this in the newspaper, but Thaddeus Stevens, who was the representative from Lancaster, they had political conventions on the Fulton stage as well, largely leading up to the Civil War. And Stevens would go and he would speak, and the press was completely vitriolic and, absolutely. We think Fox News is bad now, but they were really, it was the Democratic this and the Republican this. And so the Democratic paper, of course, hated Stevens. And they wrote about him. He had a club foot, famously. And the line in the newspaper was, "Thump, lump, lump, thump. The old heathen took the stand again." just amazing. So we're pretty tame, honestly, yeah. By comparison. I mean, it was not a politically correct era, but but yeah. But it did make me understand television. I mean, just this need for people to have constant flow of entertainment. They didn't have much in the way of sports. I guess that's the one thing. Mm-hmm. There was a little bit of wrestling on there, a boxing match at one point,
right.
I think.
The film, the boxing match, yeah. Remember that yeah. passage. Bringing up the media, this is a bit of a tangent, but we learned this week that Ann Arbor News is no longer covering most sort of live entertainment. There is still a little bit of coverage of theater specifically, which, of course, I think we've sort of seen it coming. But of course, well, there you go. So we now live in a town that does not have a sort of daily paper of record that really rigorously covers the arts, and you could, the performing arts, and I suppose you could make the argument that it's been that way for a little while now. But I wonder what that means, and certainly given the kind of record that you were able to draw from in writing this book.
I think you were saying that to me, Jeff, the other day about when you think about what's lost when you don't have a daily newspaper. Pity the poor historian 100 years from now who comes back and tries to tell the history of this town. During these years, there's not. I mean, I don't know where you would get a record. I don't know. Who came here? What they did? Wow, how people reacted. It doesn't have to be long, but even just a sort of log. It's so that part's gone. But I think also as a it's a way of taking it seriously, that the cultural life of this city is not just entertainment, it's not unrelated to the way we live and to the community, and I think that's, it's a sort of almost, I don't know, it's, maybe other people have ideas, but it's like as if to say this doesn't matter, this is so peripheral to who we are as a community, we don't need to talk about it.
It doesn't deserve reflection.
Reflection or anticipation or explanation.
Or it doesn't bring in enough revenue. I mean, I'm guessing this was a money-driven decision. Yeah. Like to stop publishing the TV schedule.
Yeah, it's a really good question, given that they don't... It's a paper that doesn't really print anything much anymore. And it does sort of intersect with questions about how... again, technology is impacting because, of course, if you're only thinking about sort of clicks or eyeballs on or impressions, that would be my guess would be that they're just not putting the sort of full kind of resources behind getting the kind of exposure for the little bit of writing that was still being done.
And
it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy is what I'm saying.
It's also this question about how do you create a community? How do you build and develop and strengthen a community? You know, live performance is certainly one way that happens. Mm-hmm. Churches, obviously. And that was something that was very interesting to me working on the book about, the overlap between the functions of a church and the functions of a theater, secular place of congregation. But a newspaper is a huge part of that, too. I mean, how do we know what we're thinking? How do we know what's even happening in our community without that forum? Oh, I guess you have the web. I don't mean to be dismissive of that, but I don't know. There's a distance or something. I don't know. Somebody else. Wait. Anne.
Oh. Wait for the microphone. It's a very—it's a really interesting.
We're filming the program.
We're filming.
So we want to get your question on film.
So you must
be
heard.
Website. You must be heard. So we're recording at least.
Well, this is a bit of a diversion, but since we're talking about sources, there's a couple things I wanted to mention from the book. And one is because you're talking about Lancaster and you are from there. It was amazing how many of the people were descendants of that you know personally played major parts in the story of Lancaster and the development of the theater. And so there's this real continuity and flow that goes there. But I think perhaps the most touching moment in the book, which I believe is in the notes, and the notes have a wonderful narrative, so don't, when you read the book, don't ignore the notes at the end, was when you were talking to a civic archivist and who dealt with records from Native American tribes. And she mentions to you that in dealing with some other tribes, other than the Conestogas, people come in and talk about family connection and have stories, but no one ever comes in and says that they have a personal connection to the Conestogas. And I think that's perhaps the most tragic moment in the book for me, where the stories stop. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that almost seems like that has some relevance to a theater as well. That, you know, the stories go on at the theater, but the stories that are real from these particular people are gone now.
Right. Yeah, those African Americans who were incarcerated in that jail, and, you know, who knows what happened to them. This story was, I went to the State Museum in Harrisburg. They had done a dig in 1972 on the site where the Conestoga Indians lived. It was actually one of the early Indian reservations, and it was granted to them by William Penn, and he had signed a peace treaty with them. And they loved William Penn. And so there was this, you know, the betrayals mount when Penn's, whatever, the vigilantes come in and from Pennsylvania. But anyhow, this dig, they had unearthed all of these little rusting items that were, and a lot of them were trade goods from European trade goods, mirrors, and even medallions with Jesus Christ on them and little crucifixes. And they're not on display. They're just in the basement stored in the State Museum. And I can't remember. I just, you know, I persevered until I got permission to go see them. And so she brought some of these things out for me to see. And I was, and while I was there that day, a member of the Delaware tribe called. And because one of the things is they're looking for their material goods to be repatriated. And I asked her if a Conestoga, and the Conestogas were part of the Susquehannock tribe, and I said, have you ever gotten a call from a Susquehannock or a Conestoga? She said, never. So it does seem that they were wiped out. They were the last indigenous people to inhabit Lancaster County when the land was still a wilderness. And it is an appalling story, and Jim was talking about it before we started tonight, about, you know, obviously race and the situation with African Americans is much on our minds as a country right now, and Native American, that oppression and genocide and marginalization really goes under the radar much of the time, and it's certainly one of the prime reasons I wanted to write this book, was just that story of those 14 Indians huddled in that basement, in that stone jail. Look how cold it is now, December 27th, and it was snowing. And, you know, never to be heard from again. Even there, they were, after the murders, they were, of course, they couldn't be buried in an Anglo or a colonial cemetery because you couldn't possibly mix Native American with white Europeans. So, but a Mennonite cemetery allowed them to be buried a couple of blocks away, so they were taken up there. But then in the 19th century, they were digging around that area for the for a railroad, and they dug them up, they reburied them, and then again, I don't know, 20 years later, another railroad was being put in, they dug them up, and their bones are completely lost. Interestingly, a friend of mine in Lancaster who's written a history specifically of that Paxton Massacre was just telling me last in the fall that the Native community in Pennsylvania is very much gathered together now over another such issue, which is a pipeline. It's not the Keystone, I don't think, but it's a pipeline. They want to run in a big old oil pipeline, and they want to cut through all of this land in Pennsylvania. I think they're taking it to the Chesapeake. I'm not that knowledgeable about this, but they've the people who are trying to do this pipeline have very carefully mapped it around American cemeteries, existing, you know, above ground cemeteries, but they're just flagrantly ignoring the existence of Native burial grounds. So the Native communities are actually rallying to try to prevent this thing, which is just sort of interesting. But again, you don't hear that much, or we don't in this part of the world, I don't think.
I mean, I felt like I learned more about the sort of treatment of Native Americans on the American frontier from this book than I had, you know, in any kind of American history.
Well, I told you, and I'll say it to everybody, but if you haven't read Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, read it. It's such an important, amazing, sad book.
And the Massacre of the Conestogas is only one of many that was at Eastern Ohio and Gnadenhütten,
which was
the
not long
Moravian
after.
Indians who were a Christian population. 90 of them, I believe, were white, literally bludgeoned to death.
At Gnadenhütten.
Just systematically being.
Oh, it's if you read the description of that particular massacre, it rivals stories
that
you read
about. This is the American Revolution.
It rivals. The descriptions could be of things you've read about the Holocaust. I mean, it was an organized mass killing, and we, in the name of this country, we've got a lot to work through.
Yeah.
As a country. I mean, we just
the list continues to grow.
Yeah.
The other thing that made me think of was the passage about the sort of Native American community coming together around the theater to kind of release the spirits of in a sort of ritual, which is like a very lovely.
So in 1997, after the new theater opened, a group of Native Americans decided that it was actually a couple of people. The guy told me, a guy named Jesse Nighthawk, said he just got tired of the shit that was happening there. I just got off Ann Arbor cable TV with that one. he said, they're always coming in and messing around and taking this stuff. And he decided it was time to do something to honor the Conestogas. And so they set up this ritual outdoors outside the theater in the back where the massacre probably took place. And they it was a June day. It was very hot. They lit sweetgrass, bowls of sweetgrass and some other herbs. And there was some drum pounding, and I'm not sure. I was not there. I regret having missed that ceremony. But in any case, Jesse Nighthawk told me, and other people mentioned this as well, in the middle of that ceremony, it was a hot June day in middle Atlantic, suddenly this cool breeze swept in. And he and then it went away. And he said a lot of people felt it. And he said, I think that that meant some peace for those spirits. The idea was until one of the native beliefs, as I understand it, in the eastern woodlands, is until victims of a crime get a proper burial, they're going to be wandering in search of peace and some sort of, I don't know, home or stasis or something. And so that's what he felt happened. Then a friend of mine who worked in the theater has this incredible story. Afterwards, the Native Americans who participated in that ceremony gave my friend Barry, who had an office in the theater, gave him a piece of sweetgrass. And then the Native Americans went off to smoke a peace pipe somewhere and eat some fry bread. Barry went up to his office, through the sweetgrass piece on his desk, which is, he's one of the most like pack rat people you can possibly imagine, so the desk is just strewn with all this stuff. He shuts the door, locks it, the windows are shut, the building is locked, he goes home, and he comes in the next day, nobody's been in his office, the windows are locked, the door is locked, he opens it up, and everything on his desk has been scattered on the floor, the only thing left on the desk is this single piece of sweetgrass. And I've known Barry for years. He's not a ghost believer. but it's kind of hard to explain that one. It's interesting.
We have some few minutes left, and I just want to make sure, are there other folks that have questions or comments? Dr. Mark Clegg in the house.
Thanks. I wanted to pick up on a couple threads. I was wondering, Leslie, if you have any insights into either how the theater contributes to community,
contributes,
how it forms. You call it sort of the secular church, right? So church, we know we go and you're shaking hands and you're having dinners together and all these things. But with the theater, it's sort of it comes together and goes away without any kind of ritual of necessarily interaction. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering if you can comment on that. And then are there any lessons from the Fulton, having been one of these 300 surviving theaters, about sort of what makes it work that we could use for thinking about the arts today?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Well, the community part, I think first of all, during the heyday, this theater was running, there was stuff happening every almost every night. And it was where people congregated and where they met, where they saw one another. But I think it's real similar. When I go to something at, I mean, the Choral Union series at Hill, I'm seeing the same, you know, it's a social event. You mm-hmm. see the same people, you talk, you, and then you go to a dinner party afterwards and you talk about the performance and all of that. I mean, it's, I think that is one way that this is a really, provides a really important function. It's where we meet one another, right? It's a meeting place. Mm-hmm. And a, you know, provokes discussion and that sort of thing. So that's a short answer to
and
that.
I'll just piggyback on that. The new regime at the Performance Network, you may know, their idea is to have something happening in that building every night. It's not going to be a play all the time, but it's going to be other things.
Yeah.
But it's a kind of community center. You could say, organized and animated by people who are interested in the arts and theater.
I mean, the challenge now is, of course, you're competing against the television and the, you know, and whatever in our houses. And I mean, I'm guilty as charged on that as well. But still, I think that is a function they perform. I don't. I guess the one obvious lesson from the Fulton is, you know, there was a group of community people who cared about this theater. Some of them. Key members actually were, as Anne mentioned, descendants of like seventh generation of the Hager family who actually built the original hall. So that's a somewhat unique situation, I guess. But having people in the community who care and believe in the place. Also, the government is helpful. Once that building got designated as a historic landmark, then it was safe. Although it's interesting, I wonder what would have happened. In 1995, they did the most recent renovation of the theater, and they absolutely had to gut it and do all sorts of stuff. And one of the primary reasons for that was because it was violating all sorts of fire codes. And they had, my understanding is they had basically been told if they didn't do this, they weren't going to be able to do performances there any longer. So so somehow, you know, locals went out and they raised, I think it was $9 million, which is a small price now. I mean,
it'd be now.
At least double that now. But I guess that's, and maybe that's part of the, ties into the community question. When you create a community and that building becomes part of creating that community, people then are invested in that building. They love that building. They don't want it to go away. They understand the value of it, the history. And maybe the history is, you know, maybe that was a small part of why I wanted to write this. Or maybe I should say that I would hope that the book would contribute to that sense of why this building is so important. Mm. So, but I think, you know, some of it's a sense of history. I mean, I don't know, Hill Auditorium. You know, I think people would, although we were just talking tonight about the Freeze building going down, and that didn't stop that, did it? Loving an old building.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't know.
Did you love the Freeze building? I didn't like the bats flying down the hall in the last couple of years.
But it had potential. I mean, it did. And before you, it's a little bit, I don't know, we're circling around. It's like the Ann Arbor News. You dismantle these institutions that have been around for 100 or more years, or, you know, 70 or 80. It's easy to dismantle it. It's easy to tear it down. It's not so easy to build it back up again. And I think, you know, so you hope the community will think twice before they do stuff, but they don't.
One of the great things about the Freeze building as a student was always that it had sort of decayed to such a point that you felt like you could actually do anything in it. Which is really a great thing
when you're a student making
theater. It's just like, this place is so trash, there's nothing I can do to possibly make it work.
I
can only make it better.
I miss the True Blood. That was a wonderful space. That's a really warm space.
I was just thinking back to that theater. And that the Arthur Miller just doesn't quite capture the essence of that space. Horrible space acoustically in a lot of ways, but really kind of a great space to play in.
Yeah, well, the original Performance Network was also
holes in the middle.
You had to block a show so that.
Well, and then the leaks in the ceiling too, weren't there?
Oh yeah.
What would it be without?
Yeah.
Well, we're close to the end here.
Or the beginning.
This is the beginning of the conversation.
A
couple of things that I just want to say. And it relates to kind of this question of community and the history of performance in our community. The Ann Arbor District Library has worked really diligently as a partner with UMS to archive 136 years of our history, now on a site available to the public called umsrewind.org. It's a comprehensive digitization of all of the program books from every single UMS performance since the beginning of UMS.
That's fantastic.
Along with a lot of ephemera, photos that have been digitized. It's a work in progress, but eventually we also hope that it will be linked to the archive of the Ann Arbor News that it also exists at the Ann Arbor District Library. If you like programs like this one, the library has lots of them, and I would be remiss in saying that because I'm actually the newest member of the Ann Arbor District Library Board, so it's my duty to say come back and have another conversation like this here. We love to be able to do this, and the staff does an amazing job of putting on programs here for people of all ages.
And these are great. I mean, a community without a library?
Yeah, we're very lucky.
Yeah, this is...
This is actually the most active library in the country in its budget category. And that
wow.
you all make that happen.
Wow.
So that's something to be proud of.
Thank
Those
you.
Five stars are yours. That's what that means. So I want to thank Lee and Martin for being a part of the conversation tonight. And, of course, Leslie for a beautiful book, which is called Staging Ground, An American Theater and Its Ghost. I hope that you'll think about picking up a copy if you haven't already. Thanks so much,
they
and
are for
thanks
sale
for
here.
Being
That's
here.
Right.
And congratulations, Leslie, Thank on this
you.
Project.
Thank you.
Tell us what the next one's going to be.
Oh, I'm working on something about my slaveholding ancestors in Georgia, the Scarlets.
Whoa, more light fare.
Yeah. I just feel like it's one of those, I've got to do something about it. I don't know what.
Interesting. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.